Älskar du den här podden? Stötta den genom IKAs nya supporterfunktion. Det är helt upp till dig hur mycket du vill bidra med och det finns ingen bindningstid. Klicka på länken i poddbeskrivningen för att visa din uppskattning och stötta podden.
Normally being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Om man har tagit en paus från poddandet men inte gärna vill släppa det helt, ja, då är det bra att när man väl släpper ett nytt avsnitt så ska man släppa ett som bär lite tyngd. Jag har haft förmånen att gå på ett antal olika turer med några olika bergsguider och det är verkligen en upplevelse som jag alltid kommer att bära med mig. Och det är även en yrkesgrupp som jag hyser en väldigt stor respekt för. Därför kändes det otroligt hedrande när frågan kom om jag ville vara moderator och samtalsledare då Svenska Bergsguideorganisationen, SBO, firade 30-årsjubileum på klättergymmet Momo i Stockholm. Jag heter Magnus Ormestad och det här är avsnitt 256 av podcasten Husky. Josef Westerlund är avgående ordförande för SBO.
Okej, Josef Westerlund heter jag och är bergsguide. Just nu sitter jag som också ordförande för den svenska bergsguidesorganisationen. Där vi nu, i och med det här lilla evenemanget, så har vi lite försökt uppmärksamma den delen av att SBO, eller Svenska Bergsguideorganisationen, har fyllt 30 år. Egentligen har vi funnits sedan 32 år nu, för det är från 1990 som organisationen bildades.
Det har ju varit flera dagar, ni har haft utbildningsdagar också för aspiranterna då, eller?
Ja, varje årsmöte som vi har, så dels så har vi ju det som vi pratar om, CPD-dagar, alltså våra fortbildningsdagar som alla guider går mer eller mindre varje år eller vartannat år. Så en vanlig sån här årsmöteshelg så har vi ofta som en utbildningsdag för de som är kandidater och aspiranter, alltså de som är under utbildning, och sen så har vi fortbildningsdagar för de som är guider. Ja, alla guider ska ha fortbildningsdagar, x antal dagar upp per år kan man säga. Och sen brukar vi oftast ha också en diskussionsdag där man pratar och funderar över aktuella ämnen eller saker som har varit och hänt under året. Allt från att gå igenom olyckor och case-grejer och miljögrejer och, eller vad annat som ligger på tapeten. Och sen självklart så har vi då det som är årsmöte, men en sån här årsmöteshelg så innehåller väldigt mycket olika saker.
Så lite social events, middagar och cocktailpartyn och en boulder-tävling som pågår precis utanför oss nu också.
Så är det, i år är det ju lite speciellt då, i och med att vi fyller 30 år. Men en av grundgrejerna med att egentligen ha en så här lång årsmöteshelg, det är ju att träffas och kunna göra saker tillsammans. För det är, alla guider så är ju mer eller mindre utspridda över halva, och nu, åtminstone hela Europa då. Det gör ju att det är inte så ofta vi ses på ett och samma ställe, vilket gör ju de här middagar och träffar och bowlertävlingar och allt annat, så det är ju så väldigt kul att bara umgås, och det är en ganska viktig del i som själva också arbetar med att känna varandra och sådana här, och tryggheten när man är ute.
Kan du berätta lite om SBO, för att du är själv boende i Finland. Vi sitter nu i Stockholm och det är olika nationaliteter som har varit med och som är med under de här dagarna. Hur är organisationen upplagd idag?
Ja. SBO, så kan man säga att SBO är lite av ett nomadutbildning, kan man säga. Att vi utbildar ju i väldigt många olika länder runt om i Europa då. Och vi tar ganska hårt fasta på den delen, att vi försöker vara så internationella som möjligt. Och det gör ju att, ja, så att utbildningarna finns ju lite här och där, men det gör också att vi är mer eller mindre ett uppsamlingsland för en massa mindre länder, som till exempel Finland, Island och Danmark, så går ju många gånger genom SBO då. För att vi dels är SBO en liten organisation som inte, det räcker inte till med svenskar för den, helt enkelt. Men sen de här grannländerna runt omkring då som kommer in, och där försöker vi som hjälpa till så att folk ska kunna gå på ett smidigt sätt då, genom vår utbildning då.
En fråga som jag har tänkt på de här dagarna nu inför förberedelserna inför det här också, att när det är så här många olika länder, kan man prata om olika bergskulturer i de här länderna och hur de på något sätt har de förändrats under de här 30 åren som SBO har funnits? Liksom, nu pratar vi Norge, vi pratar Finland, Sverige, Island, Danmark kontra den kanske europeiska dominerande bergskulturen kring alpländerna. Finns det en clash här? Eller har det liksom varit en process där kulturerna på något sätt alla blir mer och mer jämlika och jämställda?
Så när vi pratar om de skandinaviska länderna, eller Finland och Skandinavien, med Finland inte vår räknat till, så där skulle jag säga att jag tycker jag nog att vi på det viset har dragit under alla år någorlunda åt samma håll. Klart att det finns skillnader i språk och sånt här som gör att det blir utmaningar att träffas och sånt här. Så den skandinaviska friluftskulturen, så upplever jag ju att det har varit ganska liknande i det att det är någonting som är väldigt rotat i bara sättet att vara eller kulturen vår. Så att vår friluftskultur jämfört med till exempel vad alpländerna har eller resterande Europa, där ser det ju annorlunda ut. Jag tror att en av orsakerna till det är ju så bland annat vår allemansrätt som gör att vi har haft möjlighet att skapa en helt annan sån här kultur av att vara ute med dem. Så vidare. Det finns en clash däremellan. Det ser jag väl inte riktigt. Det är ju alltid, ska vi säga, SBO i sig, så vi jobbar i så många olika länder, så försöker man ju också anpassa sig till vad som gäller i de länderna så gott det går. Det är en ganska viktig del i det, att lära sig att göra det så att det inte blir de här clash. Men det är klart att,
ja, sen så behöver det inte vara en clash, jag vet inte, det var kanske olyckligt ordval, men kanske mer liksom att man märker att så här, olikheter, att det liksom kan vara lite.
Men så är det ju, alltså, om man tittar på Frankrike, Italien, Schweiz, Österrike och Tyskland och skandinaviska länderna, så att klart att det är ju olikheter, och det finns alltid utmaningar när det finns olika språk, och det gör ju att det finns också olika syn på som hur man ser på kulturer kring bergsporten och sånt här. Men jag skulle säga att Skandinavien kanske är ganska, vi är inte lika vana med att ha, vi är inte lika vana med guidekulturen som till exempel alpländerna är, där det finns en lång tradition med guidekultur. Det här börjar ju också ändras väldigt mycket i de skandinaviska länderna och i Sverige och sånt här också, att det blir och mer guidning, och det kanske har att göra med att folk vet mindre och mindre om egentligen naturen och hur vara ute och sånt här då. Så jo, det finns skillnader, det gör det. Det är det korta svaret på den här frågan då.
Men som allt annat som har med kultur att göra, så är det är inte en statisk stadie, utan det är hela tiden någonting som förändras och utvecklas, och idéer som man byter med varandra och så att säga förenas och så.
Hela poängen som är själva IFMGA då, International Federation of Mountain Guide Association, är ju att binda samman länder som har berg, och att möjliggöra att man ska kunna resa och göra expeditioner och upptäcka varandras berg och länder och sådär. Och det gör ju att det blir en väldigt speciell community också med inom bergsguiderna. Så oavsett om du är i Sverige eller Norge eller i alpländerna, så är det folk som är bergsguider, så finns det ju en väldigt stor respekt och vilja att hjälpa varandra. Så upplever jag det.
Du lämnar ifrån det ordförandeskapet nu, SBO. År 2022, snart 2023, var befinner sig SBO idag på den här 30-åriga resan?
Det är en bra fråga. Vi är en liten organisation som växer. Vi är i dagens läge en liten organisation som är väldigt väl respekterad, eller vad man ska säga, från de andra IFMGA-länderna. Och det arbetet så sätter vi ju väldigt mycket tid på att ha goda relationer till våra grannländer och sådana här, och andra europeiska länderna. Så vår uppgift skulle jag säga att bli större och större, i och med att också behovet av guider och folk vill vara ute men inte har kunskaperna för det. Så att vi är en liten organisation som sagt och säkert växer. Sen kommer vi knappast att växa jättemycket, för det finns inte allt för många människor som kommer på den sjuka idén.
Exakt, som är tillräckligt galna.
Ja. Jo, för det är ju ett väldigt speciellt jobb och så vidare. Ett smart val att bli bergsguide, så det vet jag, ja, gudarna om det. Men det är ett visst folkslag, eller vad man ska säga, som dras till det. Och framförallt, har du den här personen och vill göra någonting, så är det ju ett väldigt starkt arbete som ger väldigt mycket också.
Om man lyssnar på det här och känner att man kanske är en av de här som är tillräckligt galna för att ta nästa steg, vad ska man göra då?
Du kan ju börja med att vår hemsida, där finns ju alla förkravslistor och vad som behövs för att kunna söka till utbildningen. Och sen finns det ju att bli klippklätterinstruktör, och sen det finns ju alltid möjligheten att ringa till någon i styrelsen eller i utbildningsgruppen för att förklara vad som gäller eller få den här informationen. Och vill man ha tips på vad man borde göra för att snygga till sin ansökningslista och sånt här, så det är ju bara hjärtligt välkommen att ta kontakt. Det är ju sist och slutligen vanliga människor med ett stort intresse som blir bergsguider.
Tack så jättemycket.
Vi spelade in två samtal under dagen, och eftersom deltagarna var från Sverige, Finland, England och Island kom bägge samtalen att ske på engelska. Det första samtalet kallades SBO, Past, Present and Future.
Almost, correct enough. First of all, I just want to say a big thank you to the SBO organization. I feel very honored to get this invite. I've been fortunate enough to share some really memorable tours with some of you mountain guides in here, and it's a profession that I highly respect, so it feels very good to be able to give something back in this context. So this will be more of a discussion, I hope, rather than an interview. And I guess most people here know who these guys are, but for the sake of courtesy, common courtesy, we could just, if you could just introduce yourself, starting with you, Mr. Mark.
Hi, my name is Mark Diggins. I've been a mountain guide maybe for 40, 45 years. I've been involved with the development of the SBO from the beginning, 30 years ago, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So, I'm just going to talk today about my experiences with the SBO and development.
Hi, I'm Joonas Alajuoma, and I'm also a mountain guide aspirant, in the same class with Martin and Karin, which you just saw here. On that path to become a licensed mountain guide, we have our last exams coming in January and in March next year.
So Mike Wright, I've been working more than 20 years, and I've been responsible for the training, technical director for the training for 10 years. So this is my final year, so I'm stepping down now. But it's been really interesting to be giving to to the organization in this way. So yeah.
Okay, I'm Thomas Weber. I became a mountain guide in 1999 and like one of the early groups. I worked partly as guide and also have done other work, and I think I can maybe contribute with some memories from the early days and some reflections maybe from a little bit the outside of being a mountain guide.
Sounds great. So Mr. Mark, could you take us back some 30 plus years? How this all started and how it came to be, who were the key actors, and why did you become involved? Why did they choose you? Did you lose a bet and you had to do this as a punishment?
Yeah, that's a question I often ask myself, but why me? But actually, no, everything's fine. I think it's very interesting to go back 30 years, and I was invited to this function that it was 30, they said 30 year anniversary. I said, really? I thought it was maybe much less than that. So it's a real surprise to me that it was 30 years ago. But I think we shouldn't underestimate the role that Johan Arnegard played at that time, more than 30 years ago. And I think it's good to reflect and look back at that time and the culture and the environment that we were in the UK, and actually also in Sweden, there's a really, really strong amateur ethic. And so anybody operating or working in the mountains for profit or for gaining money was really absolutely a no-no. It was mostly volunteers. It was, so that was the sort of situation. So that was the climate that Johan was in when he thought, okay, I've been to the Alps, I've been to Chamonix, I've seen how mountain guides are operating and their professionalism that he observed at that time. You know, this would be really good for us. And so he tried, of course he came back to Sweden and discussed these ideas with communities and peoples, and there was resistance against it. People didn't think that it would be appropriate because of this culture of amateur culture and not profiting from working in the mountains, etc. So that was a hurdle for him to cross, and the group that Johan got together in those early days. And I'd maybe just like to bring in Dick here, because Dick was part of that group. And Dick, it'd be really interesting because that group formed, and what's the story behind that formation and your thoughts on having an award, the badge?
How did I get involved in this? Okay, Dick Johansson. I'm in the first group. We were five people. I think I'm the only one here today. Yeah. One of the other guys is in Antarctica now, and the other guys are at home in Swiss. Why? I think that Johan from the beginning had made this special work at Idrottshögskolan, where he actually were speaking about, do we need mountain guides in Sweden? And he came to the conclusion, he did this with another guy, Micke Franzén. He did this, and the conclusion was that we need guides. And from there on, I came in, we started with some seminars, bringing all people together, which were actually then working. And like Mark said, the ethics was quite strong towards making money out of guiding. So I remember the first meeting, there were all these testosterone guys. And they said, okay, all of us here, let's certify each other. So let's be mountain guides. And both me and you, and we had another agenda. We said, no. We want to aim for a higher goal, and that's becoming a member of the IFMJ, the International Federation, because we wanted to work in the Alps. And from there on, it went on. then Johan, who did the sort of the big work there, he spoke a lot, networking a lot, came in contact with Mark. We had a couple of more seminars. And then in the early 90s, I can't remember now, it's so far in the distance, we had this meeting in Täby where actually the organization was founded. And when the organization actually was founded, the interest from these people who were with us from the beginning dropped like that. So no one was actually interested then. And we had to take a lot of shit actually in the beginning. And I said to Mark just 50 minutes ago that it's actually just in the recent 10 years that we actually, when we are now around 60 guides, that you could actually see that the acceptance for making money out of this is accepted. Yeah. So I think that's the... I think Johan, he had this view from the beginning, and now we are speaking about Johan because he isn't here. He's quite ill. He has a problem with his eyes and so on. So, but otherwise, he would be here. But without him, we wouldn't be here. So, yeah.
Thank you. So thanks, Dick. So I came into the scene, invited by Johan, and obviously I met with these five very experienced climbers, skiers, mountaineers. And for me, I was also the training director back in the UK with the British Mountain Guides, and I designed a new system for them. And I think there are similarities in us as peoples, I think. Drink a lot. and the ethic, of course, was very similar. So it was quite daunting for me to become part of this and to start this process. And so, as I said yesterday, I had said to Johan that really this is a 10-year project. After 10 years, we hope that IFMJ would accept us. And indeed, that's what actually happened. But I felt that in order for that process to be absolutely successful, that the guys that I was working with had to be of a really super high standard. So there'd be absolutely no question at all when they're observed by others from the IFMJ that these guys were really good and that the SBO should be accepted into the IFMJ. So there were some hard times and some lots of challenging stories, which I'm sure keep growing and developing. So that was the start for me, maybe.
But it was, I take it, at some point the Swedish would-be guides, that they would have to kind of prove their spurs for the European organization. Did they put them to the test in the beginning?
So the process for me was to work with them in all those disciplines of the skiing, navigation, ice climbing, if you like, put in my thoughts and my experience in what I'd done back in the UK and the standards there. I would generate that standard with the first five. So that was quite a long process. So that was probably about 8 years, I would say, of those courses in those different disciplines. And then when we felt we were ready, they applied to the IFMJ, and then people from the IFMJ came, observed, and then they did the examinations of the guides, your guides association.
But some of the reasons behind the forming of SBO was in part to enable like domestic to be able to operate in Sweden and Scandinavia, but also for Swedish born mountain guides that they would be able to operate in the Alps, for instance, on the same terms as the locals.
Yeah, it's to become of a standard whereby you can operate worldwide, but also I think having the IFMJ status would give the SBO a really good status also worldwide. And so I think that was the ambition. So it's not so much the objective, this is what we're going to do and where we can work. It was actually, okay, if we're going to be credible, if we're going to have a long goal, and as Dick said, it's 30 years to now, it's, you know, the fruits of it are developing, are present, then, you know, that's being a part of the IFMG was important.
But what has been the perhaps the most surprising challenges for this, like, for this taking more or less 20 years to become, like, fully accepted and established and so on?
One of the key things right at the very beginning is the transformation from and the molding of an individual. And an individual, everyone here is really talented and really capable in their own sports and activities, and they're driven by their own ambition of grades and places and so on. When you become a guide, that's a significant change in that you now have to, you're not going into the mountains for your benefit, although your experience and enthusiasm is part of it. You're going for the benefit of the people that you're taking into the mountains. And that transition is really quite subtle sometimes. And so that was quite hard to achieve in the beginning. I explained yesterday about, you know, if I'm just going ski touring and I want to go up that mountain, I pretty much go in a straight line. But if you, but that you would exhaust clients doing that. So, you know, it's, you choose a more gradual way of going up because it's better. So that's just one simple example. So that was the biggest
challenge. To perhaps fast forward a bit and open up the floor a bit for more discussions. A lot has changed over 30 years. Like the skis have grown fatter, the equipment lighter. We have social media and climate awareness and so on. What would you say, sitting here, like, what would be the biggest changes over these 30 years from the perspective of a mountain guide and the mountain guide profession?
Maybe I could just say the thing that doesn't change is the fundamental guiding skills of how you manage the short roping, moving in mountains, dealing with people, looking at hazard, dealing with hazard. That is, those things change, and they probably haven't changed. Those same ways to do things were being carried out in those first ascents of the Alpine peaks in, you know, 1890s and so on. So that hasn't changed. But I'm sure these guys, social media and people's access to information, that's changed dramatically. So maybe if someone else could answer that question.
Yeah, I agree with that. Absolutely. It's been, it's so much information nowadays. It's like on the internet and on different platforms, you have pictures and route reports and so on, which is also a good thing because then we know about maybe the new dangers or like dangers that come with the climate change and the warming and so on. So we get kind of a heads up without actually going somewhere ourselves and realizing like shit. It's like now we're not in a good place. So it has its goods and bads, plus and minus. Guys.
Does it work now, this one? Yeah. So yeah, for me, I see the biggest change, the information is of course a big thing. But also the people that we get as clients today, they have a more pushy agenda, what they want to do. As I see it, when I started, I could decide more or less what I wanted to do with my clients. But now they have, I want to do this, and I've seen this, this tick list, and this route, or this descent, and they have that. Otherwise, they do it on their own. Mm. They're good people. They can do certain things. So they go with a guide to do these really difficult things. And with the changing environment of global warming and the conditions that change, so it's a much, much more complex environment to deliver these things. So a big part of the guiding skill, or what the guide really needs to be able to do now, today, is to say no. no, we can't do that, not this week or maybe next year. I mean, that's a big, it was much more stable when I started, the conditions, you knew you could do safe skiing in a certain week. Now it could be, oh, we can't do anything. We have to really stay down in the forest.
Yeah. Because it's less predictive.
Yes, it's extreme weather coming and going, and it's also before when I started, I could, after a snowfall, I could ski 10 days with clients untracked if I moved around a little bit. Now, because of the information, it's much more difficult to deliver what they want, this untracked, nice skiing, for example. You want to deliver that product that they expect, and it's more difficult today.
Can I just come in on one point there? And that is that, one of the greatest challenges as a guide for me was, you know, you've got to earn a living. And, you know, someone engages you to go on a journey up a mountain or something. And I used to find myself under a lot of pressure to deliver. And then I just had a flip in my mind. And I thought, right, okay, if I think it's too dangerous, or I don't like it, or I'm not comfortable, I say stop, I'm not going to work. I would rather not get paid, lose money, than actually be in that situation with a person which I feel uncomfortable with, because you have to respect that gut feeling. If something is not right, then, and you ignore that gut feeling, then it has consequences down the road. So to me, that was a really bit of an epiphany. So once I started to put that in my mind, then I was able to just refuse or go down or say, look, I'd rather give you your money back than put myself in a situation where I felt really uncomfortable. So that's going on your point. I don't know whether you felt that,
Thomas.
No, I think the coming back to Michael's competence, conditions, I mean, like, it's not only that today it's more variable, but also the more extreme guests, they want to do the more extreme things because they've seen them on YouTube or on Facebook or whatever. They don't understand that this is someone who's waited for these conditions maybe 2 years to ski this very radical couloir or descent or whatever it is. And they, I have the book this weekend, I want to do it. It doesn't work like that. And that's where we need to trust our knowledge and competence and sort of in a good way have the client to change their mind to something more realistic.
Yeah,
I think that's...
And do you find now that because of social media and people's desire to do carry out an objective that they've seen, do you find that there is a mismatch between their ability and physical preparedness to actually being able to do those things? So they're so affected by the image and putting themselves in that situation, actually, they're often physically not as strong either. Mm. Do you find that as well?
I think both yes and no, because yeah. Some clients, yes, but also I think that it's a general trend in society, like with health and fitness. So many clients are reasonably fit and they spend a lot of time training. So, but I think it's more they are maybe fit for an hour or two in the gym, maybe not the full day on the mountain.
Exactly.
Which is, of course, also another thing.
Yeah.
And I guess one good thing is that as a total rookie, like who've never partaken in any courses or anything, you can still read up on it online, and you can take courses, maybe not courses online, but you can look through hours and hours of YouTube videos and listen to podcasts and whatnot, and to set forth in the mountains with some kind of assumption that now I know mountains, and then when they hire a mountain guide, they approach you with some kind of cocky attitude, like, well, I've been doing some studying about this and so on, and you have to kind of balance that.
I mean, yeah, I think yes, and to some extent, but I think the one that it's, if you hire a guide, you do it because you want the comfort of the professional advice. I think the one that you maybe allude to here is the one that don't hire a guide. Okay.
That's right, actually. Because there are some people, it's a bit like if you look at an onion, right? An onion, what they see is only the skin. But we actually can see all those layers. And so when we are making a decision about doing something, we see all those layers in an onion, whereas somebody who wants to engage us doesn't. So I think that's something that we have to consider as well. And that's that type of person. But also that once you become a guide and once you have some clients that come with you, and often they stay with guides for many, many years, it's because they have a connection with that person. And it's not just about, you know, grades. It's about the fact that the guide has empathy. They have a really good connection and understanding. And you are ambassadors for the mountains, and you are there to introduce people to the environment that you're passionate about and which you love and why you become a mountain guide. So there are two very different types of people, I think.
I have one thing that I think is kind of a big change and also a big kind of challenge for us. The smartphones today, people are so kind of, they trust the information on the iPhone or the smartphone so much. So you have for avalanche information, for example, it's a 3 today. There's an accident 2 years ago up in Norway where I worked, and it's been a storm for days. And then it was a 2 before on the scale, the avalanche scale. And because of no information coming, and Varsam put out a low because there were no information coming in. So I was like, how can it be still 2? So people planned, they looked, these young people, they looked for the weekend. Oh, it's a 2. Ah, so then what can you plan with a 2? That's they trust information so much. And I was like, this is wrong. Huh? I know from a storm with this amount of snow coming, no one knows what it's out there. It can't be a 2. Or like it's very unlikely that it's a 2. So they planned a 2 aggressive tour, a normal tour, but still a little bit aggressive, and they both died. And I was like, it would have been better in many ways that if you don't have that wrong information, then you would be more...
It gives
more,
a false sense of security.
Yeah, it's a false because of what you trust in the phone. Instead of having knowledge and taking some years to learn before you start doing that route, with your own skills, it's good conditions, let's go. And they were 18 years old.
If we look at the clients that hires mountain guides, has there been any changes from like from the 90s onto the 2000s and so on? Like what type of people decides to hire mountain guides? Your typical client today versus the typical client when you started?
When I started, it was mostly in the Alps. I've been working mostly in the Alps, but now I see that, and up in Scandinavia, it was like Frilufts culture of you do it your own, you have your big backpack and you go out and you tent and so on. But people didn't. And the same in Norway, I think, very strong culture that you do it on your own, and that have changed now. Younger people, they want to, they have 1 week or they have a short window, and they hire a guy to maximize their experience and what they can do with that vacation, and then they hire, and if that goes in society in general. I think you hire specific professionals for if you're a golfer, you have a pro that helps you to develop and so on. So it's like you're looking for that professional help to maximize, and that is what younger generations look for also in Sweden, I think.
But I would like to say, generally speaking, the wealthy people. People with money are the people that engage guides. And you know, obviously you can come up with some good people, but there are also people who, because they have money, they think they can actually buy the outcome, and they put pressure on you. So I recognize that. And recently, I did some sort of volunteer work, actually, with youth who were sort of on Outward Bound. There's a thing called the Duke of Edinburgh Award, which we have in the UK, which introduces people into the outdoors. And I thought that was absolutely fantastic, because I went right back to the grassroots, to youngsters who were just wanting to engage in the mountains. There's no way they'd be able to hire a guide. So I just felt that was a really good thing to go back to, because I just felt it's not all about money, you know, it's not all about money and engaging me, okay, to earn a living. But it's more than that for me, about introducing people into the mountains. So that's just a thought.
And another thing that I've thought of, you already touched upon, is that the core of the profession is so basic. So it's kind of it's impossible to kind of change and make that more efficient and so on. I mean, you're not IT consultants that you can kind of replace with an AI app or something.
You have to like people.
Yeah. But what parts of the mountain guide profession can you improve? What part of the profession has seen the most changes over the years, if you know what I mean?
I think that the development of technology is something that can help enormously, because a lot of the work is like preparing and knowing the right conditions on the route and all things like that. And especially if you go to a new area where you haven't been before, you need to sort of learn about it, read into it. And I think technology like smartphones, it's very, you can document very easily and share. So I could see like a professional app for mountain guides that would be sharing route data. So you would put in everything you do and you get access to what everybody else do.
Open source database.
Yeah, but you need to run it. But I could see that kind of application work. I don't know if there's a business in it, but it would be a powerful tool for guides if you can, with the skills that the mountain guide have, you need to add judgment to that information, which is not what you maybe get if it's like on an open internet forum. So, yeah, I think that could be one thing that where you could leverage on the skills and experience of other guides and share that information.
Make planning easier, but still, I mean, once you're out there on the mountains, there's not much you can do when you set the plan and so on, and you can't.
But I mean, like, that would be the flip side of that would, of course, be that historically you had the local guides that had the local and knew all the, so there would be like a conflict to share that information with others, but I'm just sort of painting a picture of what could be done.
It's quite interesting that, because in social media we're surrounded by influencers, and influencers are, you know, can become great influencers just by the volume of time they spend in social media, but what they're telling may not be the truth, and it might be misleading for the public. And so that's why I think for mountain guides and SBO is to really position yourselves as great influencers, and social media plays a really important part of that. So you can put yourself in that influencer position, then I think that's a good position into the future.
Speaking to you, Jonas, as a younger generation, first of all, why did you decide to become a mountain guide? What brought you into this career path?
I think just that I noticed how much I love to be outside and just like share my passion to more people, take people outside and show them what we actually can do there. Because it's like, especially in Finland where I come from, it's like the mountains, we don't have any mountains to start with. So if I can show like what's possible, what we can do out there. It's like, it's amazing. I can open up a new world kind of to these people. And yeah, I think that's one of the main reasons.
And when we're talking about like social media, for instance, I mean, you have a social media, you have an Instagram account and so on. Do you think that you will come into this with other tools than the generations before you? That you will work in a different way? Because I think with social media and as a mountain guide, you gain a big marketplace and you kind of a window to the world, make yes. it easier for people to find you and book you and so on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a necessary tool these days. It's like you kind of almost have to use it. I mean, I think when, I'm an aspirant now, I haven't been working for too long and have 1.5 years, a bit more now. So I'm still building up and like hoping that I will get returning customers and guests. Like I think Mark mentioned that you can build this relationship. But I feel like, especially now to start, it's a powerful and a necessary tool nowadays to have like this social media, Instagram and so on to show as many people as possible what you're doing, what you're up to, and what you can provide.
Have you revised your marketing strategies, the ones that's been longer in the game?
Yes, it's a pretty interesting when I look back when the GoPro came. I had clients and me myself, I had one GoPro in the back and one in the front, and we did a lot of time in the day to just record this material. So it was updating the Facebook and whatever, and it was like the clients were really into it and I got into it, like marketing, and it was for fun. It's kind of a product that's inside the guiding to get that good footage. Yeah, but for me it ended up coming becoming too much of the time looking for that documentary material to be,
because it took time and focus and energy from
it's more important to get that photo or video than to be there in the present, to be in nature, to be connected together, experience this unbelievable sunset or sunrise or powder. How was the shot? I was like, so I more or less stopped myself, actually, because for me it became a threat to my own way, how I wanted to be in nature. And I think that's, if I look forward, I think it can become too much with social media and so on. You need to market for sure to show that you're in the game and that you're doing good stuff and you're in, as a product. But be careful not to make it more important than the core
than the quality
of your activities. Yeah. And the relationship with people. Oh, we're out here together. We don't need to have the smartphones out all the time, because it can also pull you away from assessing the dangers and so on. I mean, instead of taking photos and films and
taking all this into consideration and try to look forward, like say 5 to 10 years, how do you all think that the mountain guide profession will develop? How will it look like in 10 years, Thomas?
I think it has a bright future, because I think, as Mark said, you need wealthy people as clients. And I think what I see as trend in society is you get a separation. So you get, I see it in Sweden, you get more wealthy people. And that trend is continuing, and that creates new customers basically for the. In addition to that, I think I said earlier that I see this trend of health and spiritual yoga, or, I mean, like this place here in Söder, and that will also have people moving for these kind of experiences. So that's like a second thing that I think is important. And actually, thirdly, I think that society is getting more and more regulated, if I may use that word. Like, when we were kids, you could do stuff and no one knew, and it was like, it was the assessment of someone to say, that's okay. Nowadays, you can't do like that, because then there should be a protocol and who was responsible and did, was that signed off, and that sort of, I don't know, regulatory environment, I choose to call it, makes also people more afraid of going out in the mountains without a guide. But I can't go out. It must be dangerous to go out on my own. And so I need to hire a guide. So, yeah. So I think it's a bright future.
Any other thoughts?
Yes, I would say when I started with the clients, you started in the Alps and then you skied a couple of places in the Alps, and then they wanted to go to Japan, and then they wanted to go to India and South America, and I was like traveling so much, doing new things with the returning clients. And now suddenly I realized that I have a bigger carbon footprint than most CEOs, you know. So that global warming and the carbon, the footprint I have and my clients have, I mean, in Sweden they have this scam, or
flygskam,
and I think some people will not bother with it and some people will adapt, but I think also that it's going to be more, have to be more expensive to fly in the future. So I think this way of this SBO guide worked a lot like that, traveling, and in the old days it was the guide in the valley in Chamonix. He worked in the Chamonix Valley, that was his domain. And then you have the Zermatt, yeah, and so on. So that's, I think it's going to go a little bit
back to basics.
Yeah, not back, but for in some ways it's going to be more limited to travel all over the place. I think that's in the future, and maybe find more ways to work. You have a base and you work maybe in that country or something like that.
Jonas and Mark, any final thoughts? We're running out of time.
Yeah.
You have something.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah,
yes. For me, it's two very clear things. The first thing is that there's a significant climate change, and that's having a significant impact on the mountains. Us as the guardians of the mountains, if you like, we are have a job to do in terms of explaining to people what's happening. That changing environment is really becoming more hazardous. So again, you know, we can introduce people safely into those places. And then lastly, I would say you need to recognize what you have in your own country, in Sweden, which is probably one of the last great wildernesses, certainly in Europe, if not in the world. And so it's not always about going away to other places. You have a fantastic place, and you have a fantastic organization. So think of your home market as well.
So Jonas, your future workplace, what do you think of it?
Well, I live in Switzerland. I've been living there for the last seven years. And what Mike just said, like about coming a bit back to this base and like working in this one country, maybe a bit more, I can see that happening as well. Like you said about flying and so on. In Switzerland, it's, for example, it's quite easy to come to the mountains with trains and so on. So there's already been some change that I've noticed, that people want to use that advantage and like not maybe necessarily fly somewhere, but just take the train from their home, go maybe to the other side of the country, but still, you know, like traveling with the train and close by and so on. So,
and let's all hope for the more positive trends then. Thank you so much for the discussion and lunchtime. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Efter lunch och panelbyte gav vi oss in i nästa samtal. Denna gång med titeln A Fragile Life in the Mountains.
We are going straight to the next talk, which will be about 45 minutes. And after that, Oscar will go through the criteria for the competition. All right? Okay, Magnus, take it away.
Thank you so much and welcome back to a fresh set of guests. And first of all, we can introduce yourselves, perhaps, starting with you, Karin.
Yes, so my name is Karin. I'm an aspirant mountain guide. Coming originally from Switzerland, but now living both in Sweden and Switzerland. That's maybe a short description.
My name is Linus. I entered the guide program 2004. And I lived in the Alps for the first 10 years, and now I live in Bohuslän.
Yes, my name is actually Martin Lundberg, but everybody calls me Bruce. I'm a mountain guide, and I entered education in 2010, I think. I've been very active up in the northern part of Scandinavia, but I also guide in Europe and different parts of the world.
Yeah, so my name is Robert, and I'm a mountain guide from Iceland, from the last graduation class of SBO. The last few years I've been living in Switzerland and working there mostly, but now I'm back to Iceland, back to the basics, and live and work there.
And we will dive headlong into the real deep issues. Being a mountain guide, operating in the type of environment and circumstances as you do, it's, as we all know, a very risky environment. So working in a risky environment where you might end up facing life and death situation, it has to be very important that you do it for the right reason, and that you really have the passion for it. Has there been any times or reasons that you have to kind of pause and reorient yourself to kind of find the real reason why you are doing this, because you might potentially end up in a very dangerous situation, and you don't want to do that if you don't do it for the right reasons.
Yeah, when you start this mountain sports or whatever you call it, you do it for yourself, and you develop and try to be better and better, and then you start to start this guided education, and you start guiding, and suddenly your own aim and goals set aside, and you're there for the clients and trying to receive their goals and their dreams. And that passion, you need that kind of passion to be a good mountain guide, I think. And why you do it is it's a big and difficult question. To be part of somebody that receiving their dream or goal in life, and be a small part of that is very rewarding, I would say. So I think that's a big thing that keeps my passion going out, working for achieve other people's goals and dreams, and be part of that.
Anyone else? I mean, you haven't worked for as long as Bruce has, but I think you can understand the mindset as well. Do you have any thoughts about this, about doing this for the right reasons?
Yeah, I think the passion part is very important, because if you lose that, it's very hard to be a mountain guide, because it is a physical and mentally challenging job. Like, you always... Yeah, so if you don't have that, it's going to be hard. But as Bruce was saying, your own focus and your own personal challenges are maybe not the focus, but yeah, I think there needs to be also a passion to share that with other people and spread or take people into environments they wouldn't be able to go themselves. But if you don't have passion when you do that, I don't think you would be a very good guide. And clients notice that. And I have had periods when I've been working maybe a little bit too much, and I had to take a step back and take a break. And I'm remembering every time coming back and you feel the passion is back, it's so much easier to work, and definitely the clients knows it a lot.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I think I can agree on that. I believe we talked about it yesterday a bit, about the passion, and I was actually a bit afraid that I could lose it while doing the education, because also all of a sudden you have to do certain things. And so I was afraid to lose it, but I do hope I won't. And I think if this would be the case, then it's maybe time to just step back a bit, as you said, and just to recharge. Because it would be a pity to lose this passion, because I guess that everyone who's sitting here started because they were passionate about being outdoors. But then all of a sudden you can share it, and you can... it's another aspect. It's more this social aspect, maybe, or giving it back to someone else.
And then again, I guess it's also important to kind of remember to take care of yourself and your own hobbies, kind of to allow yourself to go on tours with friends rather than just clients, to not get too greedy and work with clients all the time, but do stuff that perhaps might be a bit risky, that you do it for your own. Like, to kind of push yourself, right?
Yeah, for me that is key, to allow you to have some time for yourself, to keep develop yourself and push yourself in the mountains as well. Because otherwise you will go backwards in your own skill set if you only guide and you're kind of doing at a level that is a little bit below what you would do by yourself. And as you said, it's also really important to keep the passion. And it is a big difference to be out in the mountains by yourself or with clients, because when you're out with clients, you're constantly thinking about their needs and their safety. And when you're out by yourself, you have a completely different freedom. So yeah, that is very important.
I don't know if you got the answer to this, but do you know, like, the drop-off rates for mountain guides? Like, is it common that once you get the badge, is it like a lifelong mission, or is it common that after a couple of years it gets too much and they decide to do something else? I don't know. What's your?
I think most guides have a 10-year period of full-time guiding. Then some stop guiding or not guiding full time after about, I think the breaking point is about 10 years maybe. But there are many guides that just goes on and do it full time for until they can't walk.
I mean, it is hard work, and it's a long way from family, so
in the beginning, I guess people are really eager to like get their to progress in the guiding stream. But after a while, maybe they need to step back to kind of find a balance for family and just personal life.
How would you guys describe the mountain guide community? What kind of contact you have, kind of unofficial contact in between each other? Because there's like, no matter if we're talking about risk, passion, or thoughts of advice to the younger generation, like, do you have and in hard times, if someone's going through a rough patch or something with accidents and so on, like, how would you describe, how does the mountain guide community react and react when it comes to this?
I can start from the guiding community is super strong, I would say. The Swedish mountain guides, we all know each other and very strong and supporting to each other. We can always ask questions, that's my feeling. And even if you travel somewhere and meet other guides that you never met before from another country, we're still strong together and we help each other. The whole community all over the world is impressively strong and helpful, I would say. I think it's hard to find that in any other yrke.
Yeah, it's important in all steps of the way. Like, we all need information from each other, networking, and also work. We share work a lot. So every time when I go to a new place I've never been before, the first thing I do is contact the local guide bureau. And in my experiences, they are always very welcoming. And it differs how active they are, but I find in small Alp villages, quite often they meet every evening and they share stories of the day, experiences, have a glass of wine. And it's a gold mine for information, especially if you're new to area. But also sometimes if you go to a place where there's not that many guides, I can experience if there's just one local guide in the area and he's worked by himself, there can be a big need for talking about difficult experience that he can't share with anyone else. And I think we have that in this community as well, in the Swedish Guide Association, that it's a place where we can share experiences.
To be part of this organization is also something that helps your passion, I would say, to be a member of this.
But is there within the SBO, is there kind of a official kind of helpline, if you will? Like, there are structure for this. If someone ends up in a bad situation and have difficulties, like, be it mentally or economical or whatever, like, but is there a working structure for this?
We do have like a doctor, like an SBO doctor that, and I think on the last annual meeting, it was introduced, and that's someone we can call with problems, whether it's, you know, regarding a tour or personal issues or anything related to the guide community. And then I guess the board, we can always contact them in case of anything we need.
Yeah, we have a contact person within the association, but also like the people that you went through the guide school with, they become really close. So I think a lot of the guides, they use that group as a debrief group.
Yeah, and because the community, it is so small that you would maybe start with your, you know, classmates, and then it quickly expands. So to find the link from here and to, you know, Japan, it only takes like 3-4 people maximum. So it's a very well internationally kind of connected network.
A lot of shared experiences, so yeah, it's easy to put yourself in the other guy's shoes.
Everyone has been through the same suffering, so
passion.
Everyone is friends.
And Karin, I was thinking, because this is still a very like male-dominated profession in many ways. You, as a woman, do you feel that you have a strong female network for this?
Actually, I just talked to one of the girls down in the changing rooms, and I think obviously there are not so many women, but the positive effect of that is that I actually have a lot of international friends, because there are such a few, so you got to know a lot of people from different countries, which is super fun. And I think it's partially because you say we suffer through the same things, but I think a passion about something, activities, it could also be music, right? It doesn't have to be sports, but that's usually something which connects, and so it's easier to connect to people. Doesn't matter if they're coming from another country or if they have a completely different age than you have, but it's very easy to connect. And I definitely think I have the fortune to that I have a lot of other female guides from different other countries. This is super fun, yeah.
But how is the development in that ratio? Is it getting more and more female guides into the business, or? And why is it still? Why do you think that there still are a lack of females?
Yeah, well, I can't really answer that question because I think it's very difficult to answer it. So I don't have the statistics in mind. I mean, I know that it's like in Europe 2-3%. I believe what I know. Talk to colleagues in mine in Germany. I think they had more. The last couple of years in Germany as well as in Austria. We have to work a bit in Sweden here as well, but we are less people anyhow. I don't know, I guess the role model is, I had role models, but it's still, I remember the first time when I came to the yearly meeting, I thought like, oh, the whole room is like full of men.
A lot of beard.
Sorry, guys. but I felt very welcomed from the start. I guess it's a long way to go, but I can't really answer for all the others, right? It's too complex.
But would you say that there are other types of challenges as female mountain guides that they encounter with regards to clients and so on that you've heard of? I've heard stories before that some feel that they have to kind of prove themselves in a different way if they encounter new guides, encounter new clients and so on.
I heard these stories as well, right?
Yeah.
I can only answer from my perspective. And I felt that I was equally treated like everybody else completely. And as I said, very welcomed.
I think we've all heard the stories about astronauts leaving planet Earth for the first time, and they turn around and look back at the planet, and they get kind of a realization of the fragile life on this unique planet, and so on. Is it just a naive wish from a naive interviewer that you, working as mountain guides, will have somewhat similar experiences, both with regards to the human life, but also with regards to climate and planet and glaciers and the seasons and the climate change and so on?
Take it away.
No. Well, we work in an environment where we see the climate changes very clearly, and we are very affected of it.
Well, I think we all had that experience a long time ago when we all fell in love with the mountains. And I think for anyone who chooses to be a mountain guide as a career, we had that experience as youths going into the mountain, because it completely changed our lives. We devoted our life to it. And I'm sure everyone have their own unique experience with that, but the mountains are, for most parts unexploited to a certain degree. So it's a place to go in and come in close contact with nature. And in this highly developed part of the world, that is quite rare. And to do that together with the strong experiences you get when you're in the mountains, I do think that changed us. And you can see it in clients as well. I think all of us had quite a few clients who at the end of the day says, this was the best day of my life. So they are connected to strong experiences. And hopefully you can also affect people and that they bring something back to their everyday life after that, to go into nature, experience it, and hopefully feel that this is something that I want to be part of preserving. And yes, we experience the changes on a daily basis, and just over the, is it 18 years I've been involved with this, there's been some big changes. So yes, we do all see that.
What I think people focus too much on mountains, because you know you have this experience on the mountain, and you know the mountain guide and all this utopian image that people have,
the mythical beast, yeah, of a mountain guide.
But in the end, we are service providers and caterers, and our guests, that's what we have, and we take them around to enjoy the day. If you as a guide provide a bad service, or you're like, you're rude and boring, you know, the day is not going to be great. The same is the other way around. If your client doesn't, if you guys don't click and there is no connection throughout the day, it's just another walkabout. So it's a really fine line of just delivering nice mountains, but you also have to connect with the people. And I mean, my best memories from work is not like the picture's view, it's the really nice moments I had with nice people. I learned a lot and they learned a lot, and that's kind of what I can take from it. But being on the mountain on a good day or skiing this powder slope is awesome. But it's even better when you just met a friend.
But this with we talked about the mountain guide community and the changing of the environment and so on. I'm guessing that, like for instance in the Alp regions, when the seasons change and it's postponed, and it feels like sometimes the windows of opportunity get smaller and smaller, and the demand of to go there from the crowds and from the clients just keeps increasing. Everybody wants to have a piece of that. Is there like a growing sense of competition that you feel that you have to, in order to keep your status with your clients, you have to be able to take them to this and this area and provide this and this experience, but then you have 100 other local and European guides in the same situation, and you're all kind of, you know, aiming for that because everybody wants to experience the same mountains, all the clients want to experience the same mountains and so on. So there's increased competition.
So like everyone is kind of on the bucket list program? Yeah, I guess so. Things come in to fashion.
I mean, I haven't been so long involved, right? But I guess some, yeah, of course. But I think there's also an increasing demand, which obviously makes it harder to navigate if you're at the same place, but gives you also a lot of opportunities because you have maybe more people to choose who you want to guide with, right? I mean, I guess the demand is increasing, and there right now at least, there is not enough mountain guides there. So it's a bit both. There's definitely all this information and all this pressure. You want to go and tick this mountain, but at the same time, it's also an increasing demand. And maybe if you're smart enough, you can maybe just change that a bit and direct you towards another location. Maybe that's a bit naive, because I haven't been so long involved, but that's my perspective, at least.
I don't feel that there's any competition. Because the clients are getting... It's more and more popular to go out in the wilderness and explore. And we are getting... We are growing as an organization, but I don't... During the high seasons, we are too few, actually, still. So if you... I don't feel that at all, actually. And of course, if you're doing the highest peak in different parts of the world, they are always crowded, and there you can feel the competition. And there is just one mountain, and they are getting more and more people to the highest mountain all over the world. So there you can feel the competition, but not like everyday guiding style, I would say.
I spent my first winter in the Alps '99. And compare what happened from 1999 to 2014 when I moved back to Sweden. I noticed a dramatic change in the amount of people who were skiing off-piste from the ski systems. So that's changed a lot. But then I moved back to Sweden. Now I mainly guide in the southern part of Norway. And even though there's increasing demand or a lot of new partakers in ski touring, I don't really notice it because there's still a lot of mountains and quite few people. And I think there's like a tendency in all outdoor activity that people tend to go to the same places. So you have these mountains that are written about, their guidebooks that recommend them, and everyone goes there, which means 99% of the rest is left alone. So, yeah.
Then again, it's perhaps up to you as mountain guides to kind of to talk about different offers. Like, we have these mountains as well. Like, not everyone needs to go to Chamonix all the time, but you can, like for instance, you, Bruce, you've decided to spend a lot of time in Sweden, for instance, work more and more there. And that was a discussion we had in the other group that. Way back in the day, it was more like every guide, you went to a place and the local guides did the local guiding. And then you had a couple of years when guides were flying all over the world, literally, to guide in, you know, on all over the world. And now the trends are, it seems to go back to kind of gräva där det står, to kind of make the most of the local places that you know the best. What are your thoughts on that trend, and your own decisions where you want to work and where you want to spend your future?
I'm trying to choose closer places to travel, mostly by train. I still fly every now and then, but I try to do it more locally. And there's so much to do closer, and great adventures and stuff. And as you said, there are more people out there, which is in northern Sweden, we just welcome it. But as you say too, the important thing is that everybody goes to the same place. So we as the mountain guides maybe have to navigate a little bit more to find those spots where we can find untracked snow, for example.
Any other thoughts?
I started my career in the Alps and I was based in Chamonix. And even though I was local there, didn't do much traveling, all my clients were flying down. I have a lot of clients from Scandinavia and England and sometimes even from the States. And it didn't really sit right at all from the beginning, but that feeling of increasing, maybe not my own carbon footprint, but I was still being a part of it because I was offering this service in the Alps. So my thought was to move back to Sweden and show the local mountains there, to work locally and also try to have local clients. So that was my shift. I moved back to Sweden or close to Norway, and I work in the southern part of Norway. And I've set like a border that I won't go beyond, and I try to find the best skiing in that area. And it's amazing, like there are really good mountains 3 hours from Oslo, no people. There are no guidebooks for these areas, but they're quite obvious. If you read the maps, there's fantastic snow, a really interesting terrain, and there's quite a lot of guides, Norwegian guides, who live in Oslo, but they don't work around there. They go maybe up to Sogndal or even further, Lofoten or Lyngen, which I think it's a shame because there's so much nice terrain just in their backyard.
I think it connects back to the previous discussions about the Instagrams. So people have some sort of an idea, they want to go somewhere and go skiing, but you can ski there, do the same kind of skiing in, you know, different countries. So often you might be just crossing the stream to fetch the water, if you will. But it's at the same time, it's hard to sell the idea to your customer that already has a mental picture of what he wants, and he wants kind of what everyone else has been doing. And it's, although you try to sell him the same, it's same, but it's not. So it's a challenge for us.
Well, the clients, they are like shopping. They, when they want to shop a jacket, they want to have a jacket with a special brand. And when they go ski touring, they want to go to a special brand, like Lyngen or Chamonix.
Tick it off the list.
Yeah. Mm. So that's what we're working against, I think. So.
Yeah, I think it's a big difference if you have clients that have been with you for a long time and they want the good skiing. That is their main focus. Then it's a lot easier to choose places that is unknown. They might even like it because it is unknown. But to sell it to someone you never met before, they don't know who you are or what you can deliver. Maybe they not skied with a guide before. Yeah, then for sure, I think it's a lot easier to sell these already quite high profile places.
So also, if you take a little bit deeper down, if you're competing on the open market and you're relying on, you know, Google search engine ranking and so on, that if you don't sell products that, you know, have high ranking, like, and that's in your keywords and your target kind of sales text, then you're just going to rank on page 2 or 3, which means nobody finds you. So it's from a different perspective also.
And speaking of offering different stuff, I mean, we are always very focused to winter. We talk a lot about winter and skiing and so on. But there is something called summertime as well, and autumn, and you can do fun stuff in the summertime as well. Is that a change in over the years that this has become easier or more difficult to work like all year round, like providing climbing expeditions and courses and so on and now we're talking about the Scandinavian context. Do you feel that there's a reception of clients that they look for summer activities as well, not only winter time?
The market in Norway that I'm most familiar with has been growing enormously over the last few years. The Norwegian Mountain Guide Association is also becoming more and more recognized in Norway, mainly because, or as we are becoming more recognized in Sweden as well. And I think for a lot of people, they had to go to the outsider mountain guide to realize what that was, to come back and find out that you can hire a guide in Scandinavia as well and have the same experience or similar. And in Norway, they definitely have that alpine terrain, and there is a market for it. It's not as big as in the Alps, and it's located to a few places. But yeah, there's definitely a market for it. I don't think that is as well known in Sweden as in Norway, because they have their own Matterhorn that everyone wants to climb.
We don't have the same iconic places in Sweden.
No, we don't. Norway is better on that. But I do a lot of guiding in summertime in Sweden. And the most thing that's growing is courses. They want to learn to do this on their own. Like glacier courses and alpine climbing courses is growing every year. And I think that's really fun. And people want to go out there and do stuff.
We ended the first discussion with a try to look ahead, like 5 to 10 years in the future, and I'm going to ask you the same. Like, what do you see in the future for the mountain guide profession? Perhaps for you as well, but also for the development of the mountain guide profession. Where do you see it in 10 years?
Well, the problem is the climate changing. In the Alps last winter was not so much snow, and this summer was super, super warm. And if it continues like this, the glaciers will be gone in like 25 and 30 years if we have the same pattern. So that's a big issue and a big concern. I was working a lot in Swiss Alps last summer, and we have a guide meeting every night before dinner with the other guides. That's from all over Europe. And the main discussion was, what are we going to do in the future, and how are we going to work? They're not super worried, but everybody feels that we have to do some changes along the way if this is going to continue.
What do you others?
Yeah, what I feel what's happening around me is that after COVID, a lot of people were forced to take time off. So, you know, they were at home. And I think that was a good realization for a lot of people that it's nice to be home also. And I think more guides are trying to work locally, both to be close to home and have less impact on the environment. At least that's what I've been hearing around me here in SBO, that people want to travel less, maybe.
Was a shift. A shift happened in the how you can work and what you really want to do.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. Many people or guides reconsider their way of guiding and way of the style of traveling, I think.
It's a difficult question to wrap your head around. Like, you have a tendency, or at least I do, to think about the future with the reference of the past. So even though you know these changes are coming, you still have the reference of, yeah, but there is a winter coming every winter. And there's snow every winter. There was snow last year, so will be snow next winter. And you know these changes are coming, and you know they're coming faster and faster. So it's a very hard question to face and to answer. I think the demand for mountain guides is growing, but who knows? There might not be a place to actually work.
It's just going to be a very long summer season.
Yeah.
Corinne?
Yeah, I think I agree with you guys. The demand is definitely there, or even, maybe higher, but it's maybe more difficult to work in situations. I mean, you have to adapt, of course. It could be also related to the topic, just the previous discussion. I guess seasons are not so stable and not so easy to foresee. So maybe you have to be more... You cannot plan it in at once as easily, so it might be just harder. But I hope, and I mean, there is still stuff to do, right? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done the training. Yeah.
It's got to be important to kind of find that, not see it as a positive thing or negative thing, but as kind of an objective thing, and kind of try to look try to make the most of it and try to make the best of it. And what you said, that the most important things is the meetings with the clients and the people, and that's going to be the same in 10 years as it is today, hopefully.
At least for me, yeah.
Yeah. So thank you so much for this discussion, and good luck in your future profession this winter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stort tack för att ni lyssnade. Och utan att lova allt för mycket så kommer detta inte vara det sista avsnittet av Husky. Så häng gärna med ett tag till. Tack.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.